All right, well, it is good to be together this morning as we continue exploring this thing called prayer, remembering that Jesus is one who prays, right? We read in Mark chapter 1, verse 35, Jesus, he gets up early, it's dark, he heads out into a desolate place, a solitary place, and we read there he prays. Matthew 14, 23, Jesus, he sends his disciples away, he dismisses the crowd, he heads up on a mountainside, and again, he prays. Luke 6:12, Jesus again off to a mountainside. And there it says he spent the night praying to God. Hebrews 5:7, we read during the days of his life here on earth, Jesus was offering up prayers, and it says with fervent cries and tears. Jesus is one who prays. But not only that, Jesus calls us to be a people who pray. And we know that because that is what it means to be a disciple, right? To follow Jesus is to follow in the way of our rabbi, to do life in the way of, meaning for you and me to do life in the way of the one who prays, to do life in the way of the one who prays. And so with that, to consider then, as we have been, prayer as it was in Jesus' day, and then to kind of also dive in, to kind of join with Jesus in pursuing his practice of prayer. Not simply just by words that are spoken. I mean, there is that, absolutely. But prayer is more than just reciting words, right? Prayer is more than just what we say. Prayer is what we do. It is to be lived out, keeping in mind as we have that at the backdrop of Jesus' own prayer life is the Amidah. What is the prayer at the heart of Jewish liturgy? Even right now here today, in our world today, but also traveling back then to the 5th century BC, where as Jewish tradition tells us, the men of the great assembly gathered this legislative and executive and legislative body that gathers together, providing leadership in a very distressful and a very difficult time, right? The temple in Jerusalem had been completely destroyed. Many Jews were now living in exile. It was a time of great disorientation and great disconnection. But it was in the midst of all that kind of challenge that the men of the great assembly gathered together, working on what amounted to four objectives, one of which was the standardizing of the language of prayer. Keeping in mind, it was done as a way of unifying, right? It was done as a way to unite a geographically disconnected and disoriented people. From Rabbi Beryl Wine. He says, the need for such formalized prayer only first arose when the Jews went into exile in Babylon, the missing experience of community that went part and parcel with the 3 times a year pilgrimage to the temple left a vacuum. Without the temple, essential nutrients in the people's religious diet were lacking. Therefore, the leaders in Babylon coded this system of prayer that substituted the temple service. And at the center of that codified system, at the heart of it, was the Amidah. Right? What is this prayer of blessing? 19 blessings, it would have been 18 in Jesus' day. Blessings of praise, blessings of petition, blessings of thanksgiving. And today I want to pick it up. I want to go back to the first petition. We've hit the praises. We've hit a number of petitions. I want to go back to the first petition and pick that up today, which reads as follows. You favor mankind with wisdom, understanding, and insight. Blessed are you, Lord, who graces us with wisdom. Keeping in mind that deep in the fabric of ancient Jewish life, the wisdom of God comes by way of the Torah. A wisdom that leads us into a particular direction or way. We see this all over the scriptures, beginning with Proverbs 2 and 6. For the Lord, we read, for the Lord gives wisdom from his mouth. And we can think of Moses up on Mount Sinai, right, with God, right, receiving from his mouth, we read, come knowledge and understanding. From Proverbs 24 and 3, by wisdom a house is built, and through understanding it is established. Meaning wisdom is not something of the intellect. It's not about being smart or intelligent or educated or academic. Wisdom is that thing which moves us toward a particular action. Wisdom is that which moves us toward a particular action. Jesus presses this home from Matthew 7 and verse 24. We read, therefore, everyone who hears these words of mine and puts them into practice is like a wise man who built his house on the rock. Right? And this isn't really about building a house, right? This is the culmination of the whole of the Sermon on the Mount, all the way back to chapter 5, all of Jesus' most significant teachings up on the mountainside. Right? And he says, everyone who hears these words of mine and puts them into practice, everyone who takes to heart what it is I've been teaching and begins to live this out, begins to move in that direction or in that way, is like a wise man who built his house on the rock. The rain came down, life happened, right? The streams rose, the winds blew and beat against that house. Yet it did not fall because it had its foundation on the rock. Verse 26, but everyone who hears these words of mine and does not put them into practice is like a foolish man who built his house on sand. Life happened, the rain came down, the streams rose, the winds blew and beat against that house, and it fell with a great crash. Now just quickly, notice a couple of things here. Both illustrations reference everyone who hears these words, right? And we can think Proverbs 2 and 6, right? From his mouth. And both the wise and foolish, in fact, do hear these words of Jesus. The difference is the practice. Poieo in the Greek, meaning to do or to make or to act. Right, again, meaning wisdom is not something intellectual. It's not being smart, it's not being intelligent, it's not being educated or academic, right? The wisdom that he's speaking here is that which moves us toward a particular action. Moves us toward a particular action. The wise put what is heard into practice. Right? The foolish do not. Over to James. We see this play out in James 3 and 13. Here we read, who is wise and understanding among you? Let them, it says, show it by their good life. Who is wise and understanding among you? Let them show it. Right? Not by their prodigious lexicon. Right? Not by their vast intellect, not by their grand eloquence. Who is wise among you? Let them show it by their good life, by deeds done. And again, here we can think, poieo, to do, to make, to act, right? By deeds done in humility. But then not only James, let's head over to the Apostle Paul. 1 Corinthians, what is probably the most extensive teaching on wisdom we have in the New Testament. It's all over especially the opening chapters of 1 Corinthians. I just want to read one little bit of it. 1 Corinthians in chapter 2, the opening line here. Paul writes, and so it was with me, brothers and sisters. When I came to you, I did not come with eloquence or human wisdom, as I proclaimed to you the testimony about God. For I resolved to know nothing while I was with you except Jesus Christ and him crucified. I came to you in weakness, with great fear and trembling. My message and my preaching were not with wise and persuasive words, but with a demonstration of the Spirit's power, so that your faith might not rest on human wisdom, but on God's power. Now, to get at that, we need to rewind for just a moment back to the 5th century BC again, where at the time that the Amida, along with its blessing of wisdom, at the time that it was being codified, there was another movement. It was a movement among the elite in Greece. It was centered around the city or in the city of Athens. It was called the Sophistic Movement, which may sound familiar to some of you. It refers to a class of itinerant professionals, itinerant teachers and professionals, called sophists, coming from the Greek word sophia, which means wisdom. A sophist being one who had a certain expertise in a particular field or discipline or study. In the 5th century, they were well respected, thought highly of. Now fast forward a few hundred years to the 1st century AD. Some put it later in the 1st century, although much scholarship says no, it came much earlier in the 1st century. But what came along was another movement that is called the Second Sophistic, spreading now outside of Greece, traveling all over the ancient Roman Empire, and morphing, really, away from its 5th century kind of professional standard, and more or less moving toward what is possibly a more prominent but less than noble emphasis on entertainment through public speaking. More famous now, we could say, for style over substance. More famous now for charisma over content. Centered more on dazzling with one's oratory than sharing anything that is honorable or virtuous or true. Dio Chrysostom, one of the 1st century sophists himself, he speaks to this, writing, "That was the time too when one could hear crowds of wretched sophists around Poseidon's temple, shouting and reviling one another, their disciples as they were called, fighting with one another, many writers reading aloud their stupid works, many poets reciting their poems while others applauded them." And it's this kind of wisdom, with all of its arrogance and conceit, that is beginning to bleed into the local churches. And Paul, in Ephesus at this point, writes this letter. He sends it to those in the church in Corinth, saying enough is enough, right? The sophism, human wisdom is not the way of God. And in chapter 2 in particular, but really all over the opening of 1 Corinthians, the opening chapters, Paul then is juxtaposing really the wisdom of God over against the wisdom of the world. In effect, he says there is this wisdom of the world, thoughts about life, what it means to be successful, how we are to get along, what is important in life. And he says there is a wisdom that belongs to God. Also thoughts about life, what it means to be successful, how we all are to get along, what's really important in life. He even uses himself as an example. Again, he says, "When I came to you, I did not come with eloquence or human wisdom as I proclaimed to you the testimony about God. And again, for I resolved to know nothing while I was with you except Jesus Christ and Him crucified." He says, listen, wisdom is not found in eloquence of speech. It's not found in the power of your position. It's not found in the size of your bank account. It's not found in your socioeconomic ranking. It's not found in your particular cultural status. Paul says, no, not at all. Rather, it is found, he says, in the power of Jesus crucified. A wisdom for sure, yes, but a different kind of wisdom. In effect, he says there is this way of wisdom that goes by the name of Sophia, and there is a way of wisdom that goes by the name of the cross. There is a way of wisdom that goes by the name of Sophia. There is a way of wisdom that goes by the name of the cross. The question is, which one do we choose? Which one do we choose? We could ask it this way, which one do we live by? Which one do we live by? Keeping in mind, yes, Paul is writing here to the church in Corinth. Absolutely. But he's also writing to you and me, right here and right now. There is a wisdom, he says, that belongs to the world, right? Thoughts about life and what it means to be successful and what it means and how it looks to get along with one another, what it looks like to be in relationship together. And he says there is a wisdom that belongs to God. Again, thoughts about life, what it means to be successful, what it looks like to be in relationship together, what is important, again, in life. And in the midst of all of that, we choose. Right? Which one do we live by? Do I live my life by the wisdom of the world, or do I live by the wisdom of God? Do I live the way of Sophia, or do I live the way of the cross? Kind of flesh that out for us. We could consider the way of Sophia, it is about elevating the self. The way of the cross, it is about dying to the self. The way of Sophia is about hierarchy. The way of the cross is about humility. Right? Which one do we choose? The way of Sophia, it's about controlling. The way of the cross, it is about releasing. Which one do I live by? The way of Sophia is about getting. The way of the cross is about giving. The way of Sophia is about the almighty dollar. The way of the cross is about the almighty Father. Which one do I choose? Which one do I live by? In the way of Sophia, authority comes by lording over. In the way of the cross, authority comes by serving under. Which one do I live by? In the way of Sophia, power comes by way of the sword. In the way of the cross, power comes by way of submission. Which one do I choose? Again, the way of Sophia, it is about taking up your life. The way of the cross, it is about laying down your life. And the question again to each of us is, which way do we choose? Which way do we choose? Which way do we choose when we're at home? When we're at work? At school? Which one do we choose when we're out shopping or eating out or hanging with friends? Which one do we live by when we're in the middle of a disagreement? Which one do we live by when we're at odds with another? Which one do we choose when we just don't seem to be getting along? Which one do I live by when I'm joyful? Or how about when I'm angry? Which one do I choose when I'm struggling? This day, every day, this moment, every moment, the question is, which do I choose? Which one do I live by? You favor mankind with wisdom, understanding, and insight. Blessed are you, Lord, who graces us with wisdom.